ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just one day after Jack McLennan's relationship fell apart, he vanished.
I couldn't believe this was happening.
Immediately, accusations started flying.
You need to cough up and you need to confess.
But it soon became clear there was so much more to the story.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the show. I'm Natasha Mitchell and this is Big Ideas. Today, a former White House insider delivers his post-mortem on the world as we have known it. Meet the author of The Inflection Point, Biden, Trump and the Future World Order.
As I look at it, the international order, as we have known it, certainly since the end of the Cold War, but even going back to the end of World War II, has unraveled. And it's unraveled not by one shock, not by the changing balance of power with China's rise, not by long-term forces beyond anyone's control. It's unraveled because of deliberate decisions taken in three capitals by three leaders who each concluded that the limits the system placed upon them and their countries were limits they were no longer willing to accept.
Can you guess who those three leaders are? Stay tuned to find out as we bring you this clear-eyed assessment by Thomas Wright, who is a former senior National Security Council official in the Biden administration. He's now senior fellow with the Strobe Talbot Center for Security Strategy and Technology at the Brookings Institution and visiting Australia as a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute. Later, Thomas will join the program director at the Lowy Institute's International Security Program, Sam Roggeveen, in conversation. But let's kick off now with his presentation, After the Unravelling, Confronting the New World Order. Join the audience at the State Library of Victoria in Naarm, Melbourne. And we love your response as you're listening. The ABC Radio National text line 0418 226 576 or email bigideas at abc.net.
Great. Thank you, Sam, for that very kind introduction and also, more importantly, for encouraging me in the first place to write the book when I think I was maybe a little reluctant just coming out of government and wasn't intending to write about my time in the administration. But you and Michael encouraged me to do so, and it was really wonderful to work with you throughout that, and I'm very excited to be here back in Australia and most importantly back in Melbourne to launch the book and to talk with you all. I would like to start this evening with the Melburnian, with a story no doubt you know better than I. In September 1951, when the Robert Menzies government signed the ANZUS Treaty, the formal cornerstone, of course, of the alliance that has anchored Australian strategy ever since. And Menzies, a lawyer by training, later observed that the treaty did not bind the United States to come to Australia's defence automatically. There was no NATO-style mutual defence clause. What the treaty did do, he later wrote, was to render common action between contracting parties of good faith against a common danger and would make that substantially inevitable. Substantially inevitable. That phrase, I think, captures something essential about the alliance system the United States built after 1945, not just with Australia, but also with Japan, with Korea, and even with NATO. The architecture was never primarily about treaty mechanisms. There were treaties, sometimes they were stronger than others, but they usually had loopholes. What made them work was the shared assumption that the parties were acting in good faith. And that assumption, I think now it's fair to say, is in grave doubt. And that is why, in a seminal speech at Davos earlier this year, the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney spoke about how the bargain that middle powers enjoyed with great powers had broken down. We are, he declared, in the midst of a rupture of the international order, not just a transition. Sometimes when we look at these issues of international order, it's tempting to be prescriptive. We can explain what we need to do to get ourselves out of the situation and to a better place. And that is indeed important. But it is equally important, I believe, not to let the prescriptive obscure our understanding of what is and what is likely to happen. And that is my focus this evening, is to talk about the nature of the unraveling of the international order and to try to ascertain what comes next. Unfortunately, my message isn't a very comforting one, not a very uplifting one, but hence the times that we're in. As I look at it, the international order, as we have known it, certainly since the end of the Cold War, but even going back to the end of World War II, has unraveled. And it's unraveled not by one shock, not by the changing balance of power with China's rise, not by long-term forces beyond anyone's control. It's unraveled because of deliberate decisions taken in three capitals by three leaders who each concluded that the limits the system placed upon them and their countries were limits they were no longer willing to accept. And the conditions we are experiencing now after that unraveling are consistent with those of a pre-war environment. So I want to choose my words carefully here. I'm not predicting great power war. War is certainly not inevitable. But if a major war were to occur, future historians would not find its causes mysterious or sudden or a puzzle. They would find them hiding in plain sight. So what I would like to do this evening in this talk is three things. First, I want to be precise about what the order actually was, because if we're loose about that, we'll be loose about everything that follows. Second, I want to walk through the three revolutionary foreign policies that have brought it down: Xi Jinping's, Vladimir Putin, and Donald Trump. And third, I want to look ahead soberly at the structures that may emerge from this period and at what the United States and our allies should be doing now to shape what comes next. So let me start maybe with just with definitions, because a lot of confusion, I think, can arise if we get those wrong. The post-Cold War order is often equated with international law or with the authority of the United Nations and multilateral institutions, or what sometimes we call the rules-based order. The critics, and there were a lot of them, of the rules-based order, point to the long history of Western interventions, hypocrisies, the invasion of Iraq, the double standards on human rights, the failures on climate, and they argue, as Mark Carney did to some extent, that the rules-based order was always a fiction, a flattering story that the West told itself. And I understand that critique, although I disagree on some important parts, but I think overall it confuses the system's failures or shortcomings with its absence. The order I'm describing is not really about institutions. It's about a set of foundational restraints that the major powers observed for decades. And I think three stand out. The first was a restraint on the use of force to redraw borders. Major powers did not, as a matter of policy, conquer and annex the territory of their neighbors. There were exceptions, of course, but those exceptions were treated as exceptions. They were condemned as violations, and they were not normalized as common practice or something that was thought to be emulated. The second restraint was a baseline of reciprocity in the global trading system. Tariffs were historically low. Markets were, by historical standards, open. Countries competed hard within the system, but they did not seek to dismantle the system itself. And the third restraint was an American restraint. The United States, as the systemic hegemon, exercised enough self-discipline to allow its allies to grow into genuine partners and stakeholders. Not vassals, not tribute states, not counterparties to be squeezed for the next quarter's concessions. And that restraint is what made the alliance system work. It's what made it durable. And within those three guardrails, the order was fairly flexible. It absorbed the Iraq war. It absorbed the financial crisis. It absorbed the rise of populism, the seizure of Crimea, even the COVID-19 pandemic, and the steady weaponization of economic interdependence. It bent, it strained, but it did not snap because of those pressures. And the reason it did not snap throughout all of that is the reason that Henry Kissinger gave us in his book, A World Restored, the first he wrote as a young scholar. And in that book, Kissinger argued that the stability of any international order does not derive from a perfect harmony of interests. It derives from a shared acknowledgement among the major powers of what he called the nature of workable arrangements, an understanding of permissible aims and the methods of foreign policy, however grudgingly. And that is the consensus that has now collapsed, not the institutions, not the laws, but the consensus on permissible aims. So how did we get here? We got here because of the three most consequential states in the international system, China, Russia, and the United States, each adopted what I want to call deliberately a revolutionary foreign policy, not a competitive policy, not an assertive policy, a revolutionary one, meaning that the policy aimed not just at adjusting the order, but at breaking the limits that the order placed upon it. So let me just very briefly go through those one at a time. And let me start with China, and because I think sequentially it was first. For most of the post-Cold War era, the story we told about China was one of integration. China joined the WTO. It became the workshop of the world. It was, in our framing, gradually being woven into our system. But that story ended decisively under Xi Jinping with the launch of Made in China 2025 and 2015. And in that, what Xi has been pursuing is not a faster version of integration. It's something quite different. It's a strategy of what we might call asymmetric dominance. The aim is to use the full weight of the Chinese state, subsidies, financing, regulatory protection, industrial policy at a scale no Western country can match, to dominate the high-end industries of the future: semiconductors, robotics, electric vehicles, solar, batteries, magnets. The strategy is to move from being the world's factory for cheap goods to being the world's dominant and sometimes overly dominant and only supplier on the goods that matter the most. And the strategy is working. China's production capacity in key sectors now vastly exceeds its domestic demand. The result is a flood of subsidized exports that no foreign competitor can match on price. And at the same time, China keeps significant barriers against foreign firms trying to enter the Chinese market. So it's trade that is, to a remarkable degree, a one-way flow. Robin Harding of the Financial Times captured the underlying ambition with bluntness. He observed that there is, in essence, nothing that China wants to import, nothing that it does not believe that it can make better and cheaper for itself, and nothing for which it wants to depend on foreigners a single day longer than is necessary. This is not a competitive economic strategy within a reciprocal system. China has, in effect, given much of the Western world a choice between the hollowing out of their industrial manufacturing base or protectionism. And many countries, including the United States, and now increasingly Europe as well, are choosing protectionism. We can debate whether those responses are well-designed, but it's clear they are a response to the Chinese strategy that came first. The second rupture is Putin's. Russia's been chipping away at the order for nearly 20 years, ever since Putin's Munich Security Conference speech in 2007. We saw Georgia in 2008, Crimea and Ukraine in 2014, the slow war in the Donbass that followed. We imposed sanctions, we protested, we sent some non-lethal aid, and the order strained throughout that period, but it held. What broke it was February 2022. Putin laid the predicate for the invasion carefully, a military exercise the previous spring, an article that summer that Ukraine was an artificial nation with no legitimate claim to statehood, and then he launched the largest war in Europe since 1945. Consider what this war has now become. Russian casualties are estimated at over 1.2 million. For comparison, the Soviet Union lost about 15,000 soldiers across the entire eight-year war in Afghanistan. It's now been at war in Ukraine longer than the Soviet Union was at war in the Second World War. And yet, and it's losing 1,500 casualties a day on average. But Putin's war aims have not moderated. He still wants all of the territory he occupies, and he wants additional territory that Ukraine occupies. He wants strict permanent limits on Ukraine's ability to defend itself, and he still wants regime change in Kyiv. He's demonstrated that a major power can wage a war of conquest in Europe at an extraordinary cost for years on end and continue. He has put back on the table for the first time in three generations the proposition that the borders of European states can be revised by force. That proposition is by itself sufficient to end the order that I described earlier. There's no version of the post-Cold War system in which large states conquered their neighbors and the system continues unchanged. And the third rupture is, for Americans anyway, the hardest to look at directly. The constant in US strategy since 1945 has been the conviction that the United States is more secure, more prosperous, and more influential when it operates as the leader of a network of alliances and partners who are themselves stakeholders in a shared system. President Trump has resoundingly rejected that conviction. He has redefined American foreign policy in explicitly zero-sum terms, and he's redefined our allies as counterparties to be pressured for short-term advantage. Consider the trade record. When the president took office in January 2025, the average U.S. tariff was about 2.4%. By November of last year, it reached 17.9%, so basically 18%. That's a near eight-fold increase in less than a year. Of course, the Supreme Court has since intervened on the legal mechanisms and the tariff rate is reduced. But the administration's intent and its determination to find some way to keep tariffs as a permanent instrument of leverage against allies and adversaries alike has been entirely clear. Consider the security relationships. For 70 years, American alliances rested on a bargain, collective defense in exchange for shared political alignment. That bargain has now been reframed. Allies are told, sometimes publicly, that American protection, even routine military cooperation on shared interests, is contingent on economic concessions, investment commitments, restraint on tariff retaliation. And consider finally the question of territory. President Trump's stated intention to acquire Greenland as a territory of the United States over the objection of Greenlanders and Denmark is a chilling manifestation of how he sees allied nations as an easy mark rather than as true partners. So I want to be careful on this. The character of American hegemonic leadership has shifted before. Administrations have always had different temperaments. But what we are seeing now, I believe, is something more fundamental than just a change in style or a change on the margins. The Trump administration is no longer acting as a guarantor of a global system. It's drawing down on the power and influence that successive presidents have built up over many decades in an effort to accumulate gains on a transactional basis whenever it can.
On Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, Natasha Mitchell joining you. This is Thomas Wright. He's a Brookings Institution scholar and former Senior National Security Council official in the government of the former US President Joe Biden. He's a visiting fellow at Australia's own Lowy Institute, where he's published the book Inflection Point, Biden, Trump and the Future World Order. And he joins you and an audience at the State Library of Victoria today.
So that's how we got here. Three revolutionary foreign policies, three ruptures. And let me now just describe four dynamics that I think shape the period that we're now in. The first is that the international landscape, as I mentioned at the top, is beginning to look uncomfortably like a pre-war environment. A familiar pattern is taking shape: the rapid rise of a revisionist power in China, deep uncertainty about the balance of forces and where it's heading, an acceleration in arms development that by historical standards is significant, and doubt over the alliance commitments that the United States has. The world's major powers are reorganizing their economies along a long era of confrontation. Defense spending is rising sharply across all the major powers, and all are investing heavily in new weapons of war, including drones, AI, and cyber. There's something else I also want to add here, something not really as quantitative, but I think no less important, which has to do with the character of many of the world's leaders. Several of the world's most consequential leaders are fairly old, temperamental, and animated by ideological visions of national revival. None would really be unfamiliar from a historical perspective if you were to look at the 19th century or before World War I. For some of them, the moment now may feel like a closing window, a now or never opportunity to reshape the international system before their time runs out. That type of mentality makes restraint harder, It makes risk-taking more attractive. We may have seen that with Putin in the invasion of Ukraine, and it's historically exactly the type of psychology that makes pre-war periods dangerous. The second dynamic is a deepening alignment of America's rivals and competitors. Russia's war in Ukraine accelerated this. Over the course of that conflict, Russia has deepened its ties significantly with Beijing, with Pyongyang, and with Tehran. China supplied Russia with the machine tools, microelectronics, and dual-use components that allowed it to sustain a war economy and to reconstitute its military. The two countries, Iran and Russia, are now co-producing drones before this war began. North Korea supplied millions of rounds of artillery, rockets, missiles, and even troops. And Russia has not received this assistance for free. It's paid in advanced military technology to other countries, technology that those countries that may in time materially shift the regional balances of power in East Asia and in the Middle East. And the implication of this, I think, is sobering. A war between the United States and China over Taiwan, which hopefully will not happen, if it did, may not stay contained to the Western Pacific. It could quite plausibly trigger simultaneous crises on the Korean Peninsula and in Europe, transforming a regional conflict into something broader. And we have to plan on that, but our planning yet has not caught up to it. The third dynamic is on the alliance, the Western alliance. Trump's treatment of allies has, by any standard, been extraordinary. The measures that I spoke about earlier collectively should have produced a fracturing of the alliance, but it is not, at least not yet. And the reason, I believe, is fear. European allies in particular do not believe that they can deter Russia without an American support. Many Indo-Pacific allies feel acutely exposed against the combined weight of China and North Korea. That shared anxiety has proven stronger than the grievances generated by American unilateralism and transactionalism. Allies have absorbed real economic and political costs rather than risk the one outcome they fear more than American pressure, which is American absence. So allies are doing two things at once. They're managing Washington in the near term, swallowing what they have to swallow, keeping channels open, refusing to be provoked, which I know is quite difficult for pretty much all countries. And they're quietly building the capacity to depend on Washington less. They're increasing their own defense budgets to be more independent. Cross-regional security cooperation is deepening. There's more talk of European autonomy, of Indo-Pacific minilaterals, of partnerships that do not run through the United States, more than at any time I'm aware of in recent history. For Australia specifically, the question of how to deepen self-reliance while sustaining the American alliance is the defining strategic problem of this period. And whether this hedging strategy succeeds depends more than anything on domestic politics and allied countries. Raising defense budgets while cutting social spending is a genuinely difficult political task. It's a task that risks feeding the very populist movements that are most skeptical of alliance commitments. This is one of the central tensions of the next decade in democratic politics, and I do not think that we have a confident answer for it. The fourth dynamic concerns the US itself. As I recount in the book for Lowy, the most important fact about American foreign policy today is not that the country is divided, it's that the division now reflects two genuinely different visions of America's role in the world, and that both are likely to remain durable for years to come. One is internationalist, that's committed to alliances, to open markets with allied countries, to a sustained American role in shaping the global order, and to the proposition that the United States is more secure when it leads coalitions than when it acts alone. The other vision, the America First vision, prioritizes sovereignty, economic protection, and a much narrower definition of the national interest. It's skeptical of alliances, comfortable with tariffs, and convinced that long-term commitments abroad do not serve the interests of ordinary Americans. These are not temporary deviations from a shared consensus. These are durable worldviews, each with a constituency, each with an intellectual infrastructure, each with a roster of officials who are ready to staff an administration. And because American politics is highly competitive, since the mid-1940s, The two parties have basically split control of the presidency almost evenly. Republicans are currently in their 42nd year in the White House, and Democrats have had 40, so basically 50-50. Neither vision is likely to dominate for long. What's changed is the size of the swing. A change in administration used to produce shifts in the margin. It now produces dramatic reversals in trade policy, in alliances and strategic priorities, and in basic questions of whether or not countries are friend or foe. And the result is that the world will have to live with two Americas alternating with each other. Allies cannot assume that a particular US strategy will outlast the next election. Adversaries cannot assume the same about American resolve. The defining feature of international order over the next 20 years may not be American decline. It may be the world's adjustment to the alternation between two competing American foreign policies. So those are the four features, I believe, that sort of will define the world. I haven't even mentioned AI, which over the next decade may genuinely reshape the balance between the great powers more than any dynamics. But that's the subject, I think, of another talk. I'm happy to get into it in Q&A. But let me close by saying something about what could come next and what I think we should be doing now. It's too early to predict with any confidence what the next international order will look like. The conditions are not yet in place for major powers to agree on a new set of limits. We're still very much in the unraveling phase. But two broad structures, I think, are visible on the horizon, at least for US foreign policy. The first is a world that's organized primarily around the US-China competition. Not a Cold War in the old sense. The two economies are still too integrated for that, but a partial bifurcation layered on top of continuing trade and financial linkages. A world of two loosely integrated blocs connected by shared supply chains within the West and in China's system, technology standards and security partnerships. In that world, the West remains a coherent and powerful entity, even if it is a smaller share of global GDP than it once was. This is the better, I believe, of the two scenarios. The second is a world that resembles much more 19th century great power politics, a looser, more competitive system in which the United States treats its allies as competitors, and the allies in turn accelerate their own efforts to become strategically autonomous. In that world, traditional alliance structures weaken significantly. Some states can reconsider long-standing taboos against acquiring nuclear weapons, and the West as a coherent project ceases to exist. The most important variable separating those two scenarios, I think, lies in Washington. The contest between internationalism and America First will, more than anything else, decide the path that we travel. But I want to end just by being honest about what rebuilding will require and how long it will take. The next several years, I think, are about something less ambitious than rebuilding. They're just about preserving what we can, investing in what we will need, and being ready to act affirmatively when the moment comes. It means preserving as much of the alliance architecture as we can in this period. It means investing in technology and in the defense industrial base in ways that will define the coming era, and in diplomatic relationships, not just with each other, but also with the global South, that we will need in the future. It means resisting the temptation in our own politics to treat the international order as something we are well rid of. We must be honest with ourselves and with our publics about what has actually happened, that the order was ruptured, that that rupture was a choice, and that what comes next will be a choice as well. The order cannot be rebuilt at the moment that a new administration takes office, mainly because the other two main protagonists of this story, Xi and Putin, are likely to remain in power for some time. A genuine reordering moment, the kind that allows leaders to negotiate a new set of limits, is unlikely to arrive until all three have left the stage. And rebuilding will require the right sequencing. The phrase Menzies used about ANZUS, substantially inevitable, described an alliance held together not by legal mechanisms, but by mutual confidence. That confidence can be partially repaired, at least by a future American administration. But it will need to be repaired in a particular way, by helping allies become genuinely more self-reliant so that the alliance can survive the next time Trumpism or something like it comes to power in Washington. And what Kissinger called the consensus on permissible aims, that will take longer. It will not be restored until there's more enlightened leadership in both Beijing and Moscow, as well as in Washington. And we cannot say with any confidence when that will be. But both of these have been built before, after periods longer and darker than this one. And the next international order will, in the end, depend on the same thing the last one did, which is the willingness of major states to accept, once again, limits on how their power is used and to act in good faith with those who have chosen to stand alongside them. That is the work ahead. Thank you so much, and I look forward to your questions.
What does the future hold? That was The World According to Thomas Wright, currently visiting the Lowy Institute in Australia. Former Senior Director for Strategic Planning at the US National Security Council under President Joe Biden. He's author of Inflection Point, Biden, Trump and the Future World Order. And we're bringing you its Melbourne launch on ABC Radio National's live event show. This is Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. Now, Thomas joins you with Sam Roggeveen, who is Program Director of the Lowy Institute's International Security Program and author of the fantastic book, The Echidna Strategy, Australia's Search for Power and Peace.
Tom, thank you. That was terrific. There's so much substance there to talk about, and we're going to get to it very soon, but I can't let the opportunity pass of asking you an opening question about your time in the Biden administration. And for all of us here tonight, I think I can speak with confidence on behalf of everyone here who's fascinated by international politics. We are obviously keenly interested, especially in what happens inside the White House and how policy gets made. And so I want to take the opportunity to get an insider's perspective on that. Maybe the way into that is by asking you about a specific crisis that you worked on while you were in that job. When I introduced you, though, I said you were the Senior Director for Strategic Planning at the National Security Council, which is a fantastic title, by the way. I hope you kept a business card. Yeah. But maybe just to situate us there, you can tell us what that means in practice and actually what is the NSC?
Yeah, no, great question. So, you know, firstly, in case you couldn't tell by my accent, I'm originally Irish. So I emigrated to the US when I was 25, which is 25 years ago, so half a lifetime ago. And I think in that situation, you know, to go work in the White House is sort of an extraordinary thing, right? It's something, because it's a different country from the one I grew up in. And, you know, I always had this fascination, obviously, with American sort of politics, and to just, I think for anyone to go work there, it's special, but I think particularly for immigrants from another country is particularly a particular privilege. I had a great job, as you said. I really enjoyed it. It was a Senior Director for Strategic Planning, and basically we worked, I had a team of about six or seven people, and we worked closely with the National Security Advisor and with his deputy, with Jake Sullivan and John Feiner, on basically the questions that they were grappling the most with. So I spent over half my time, probably 60% of my time in Russia, Ukraine. I did quite a lot on sort of US-China, some on speeches and strategic communications, some on alliances, some on international economics, so some in technology. So you really cover the waterfront. And, you know, you ask about the NSC, we had about, I think about 180, 190 people in the NSC. Now it's down to about 40, I think, or in the 30s. So Trump has really gutted it in his second term. But the NSC is really the coordinating mechanism for the government. It's the only part of the government that can really convene the other departments and agencies. Like, you couldn't have the State Department convening the Defense Department or Commerce and telling them what to do, right? They would just say no. But the White House can do that. And so the White House tries to reflect the president's sort of priorities and to corral and convene and push the departments and agencies to fulfill his wishes as he sort of intends those. And so, you know, it was a great, I learned a lot. I you know, worked on these issues for some time before, but I learned a huge amount just about bureaucracy, about the internal sort of mechanisms, and then just about the, you know, NSC is in its own way a melting pot to people who work on traditional security issues and alliances and regions, but then you also have climate and energy and international economics and all, you know, and technology all under one roof. And it's a large team, but it actually feels pretty small. And so there's a lot of integration and discussion and debate. So yeah, it was. I think that has been hollowed out to some degree since, but I think it is a very special institution that plays a really critical role.
And in the book, you recount, I think one way to illustrate the kind of work you were doing, you recount the story of the Chinese spy balloon incident in January 2023. One disconcerting detail that you relate about that is that when that spy balloon was first detected and when the issue first arose, you kept yourself up to date by searching for China balloon on Twitter.
What? Yeah, no, that was a surreal. I remember that really clearly. It was the balloon was shot down on a Saturday and it became public on a Thursday. But on the Tuesday, I first became aware of it. I was in Jake Sullivan's office about 7 or 8 p.m. in the evening. He had these sort of daily wrap meetings where he would sort of sometimes have a number of people in his office and go through what happened that day and then what was coming the next day. And I used to attend that a few days a week, and one of the things that came up is they had noticed about, you know, a Chinese balloon, but I don't know if we precisely knew it was a balloon at that point that was transiting sort of across Montana. And I think that was, that Tuesday was the moment where we sort of realized the significance of it. And there was a discussion, and Jake went around the room and he was like, who thinks we should shoot this down now? And I was definitely on team shoot it down. He was on team shoot it down. And General Milley, who wasn't in the room but was on the phone, was of the view that you couldn't shoot it down because it was a large structure attached to the balloon. And if it fell, it could have a 20-mile square radius. It could hit someone and kill someone on the ground. To which the response of some of us was, you know, have you ever been to Montana? Like, there's not a lot of people in Montana. Like, the chances of that, like, hitting someone are probably pretty low. But the next day, the president gave the order to shoot it down. And Milley, when he received the order, basically said, well, I can't really do that because if I do, you know, it could cause civilian casualties that put the president in a very difficult position. Milley had said it was an option and then it pulled back from it. And so at that point, we knew it was going to be public. So what we hoped to do was to basically quietly take it down, maybe even not say it. The Chinese would know that we did it. We would know we did it, but it would, you know, it would, was, because it was, had the capacity to take high resolution images of sensitive sites. It was very close to some sensitive sites. But we did not want it to become sort of a major, you know, like all our panic nationally. Of course, that's what happened. And we briefed Congress. And that was the point where I was sort of searching for it on Twitter, just waiting to see when it leaked, just when someone from Congress would leak it. And, of course, it did leak that afternoon. And our efforts to try to manage it quietly...
Not the balloon. The balloon wasn't leaking.
Our efforts to manage it quietly, of course, failed completely. It was shot down on live television on Saturday afternoon with huge crowds of people watching it from the coast because it had to basically get over U.S. land. But there was one point, I don't know if I think I did mention this in the book, that on the projection of the speed of the balloon, they believed that it was going to be over Washington, D.C. on the Monday or Tuesday, which also happened to be the day of the State of the Union. So we just had these images of Biden preparing to give the State of the Union while on a split screen was this, you know, Chinese spy balloon causing great panic, headed in Independence Day style to the Capitol. So, you know, that was these crazy, I mean, things sometimes happen, very surreal, very bizarre. And that was definitely one of the most surreal.
And we can joke about it because it's just a balloon, but it's a decent sort of dress rehearsal for crisis diplomacy with the other superpower in the world. So in this event, and maybe you can also expand this to talk about the Pelosi, the infamous Pelosi visit to Taiwan, which also was a major rupture or a point of tension with China during your time in the White House. So in both of those instances, were you able to talk to Beijing, and what are crisis communications like?
Yeah, they're not great, I think, mainly because of China, not because of us. I think they sort of traditionally believed that excellent crisis communication mechanisms basically are like seatbelts that could cause us to drive more recklessly, right? So they want us to be a little bit nervous, and they don't want to have a lot of stabilizing mechanisms there because they think that that might mean that we would take more risk. Our view is that they didn't experience the Cuban Missile Crisis or similar crises, and actually, if things get out of control, it's bad for everyone, and you do need someone to be on the other end of the phone. I think that improved a little bit, actually, after the balloon incident, because I think they did realize that things, you know, could spiral. But the trajectory is sort of interesting. I think of our China policy in sort of three phases. We had the first phase, basically from the start of the administration until the summer of 2022, so about a year and a half, when it was quite competitive. But the two sides after Alaska, the meeting that happened that was quite tempestuous, didn't quite ignore each other, but were sort of doing their own thing to invest in competitive advantages. It was reasonably stable, but not particularly cooperative. And then in the summer of 22, we had the start of a series of things that really had the potential, came from left field and had the potential to set the relationship back significantly. The balloon was one of those, but the first was the Nancy Pelosi visit to Taiwan, where she basically, over our strenuous objections or concerns, because the president never said don't go, because he didn't believe that it was the president should tell the leader of, you know, the House of Representatives what to do, but we had concerns about it. She insisted on going forward. China was able to use that as a pretext to engage in quite aggressive actions against Taiwan, more centerline crossings, firing missiles across the island. And that was, you know, you're asking about process. In that situation, every day, basically at 8 a.m., we would meet in the Situation Room to go over what had happened the night before, what was happening that day, and to try to keep all the departments and agencies, particularly the Pentagon, you know, all on the same sort of page, and to try to strike a balance between convincing China that, A, you know, if they overreacted, that we would push back, but that, B, we did actually favor the status quo. We did not want a disruption to the status quo. What Pelosi was doing was not sort of the beginning of something bigger to change Taiwan's status. And then the third thing that happened was a big dispute over lethal aid to Russia, when China at that point was considering giving lethal aid to Russia. And those three things together, I think, along with the tech controls, which was deliberate, that also aggravated China, I think show that the relationship had the potential to go totally sideways. And after that, there was a new diplomatic track that really set in place phase three, which was Jake Sullivan's meetings, often 12 to 14 hours long over 2 days, with Wang Yi, Chinese foreign minister, which I think were quite sort of strategic, and just each side explaining to the other what we thought we were trying to do. And I think that helped stabilize the relationship, even though we continue to invest heavily in competitive action. So China policy was definitely, I think, one of the most complex, continues to be one of the most complex and consequential issues that I think requires like very careful management, but also, you know, being competitive for sure, but also trying to inject some stability into that competitive relationship.
Well, we can be reassured then that careful management is happening.
Look,
one substantive, I'm conscious of the time here, I want to give the audience a go, but one substantive question about your remarks, and I want to provoke you here by suggesting if anything, you're being not pessimistic enough. In your two Americas scenario, I think you're basically saying that at least half the time, given that the administration gets changed between Democrats and Republicans, roughly half and half, at least half the time under a Democratic administration, US foreign policy will look familiar, and that allies can be reassured by that. That's not enough, of course, because the other half of the time will be extremely disruptive. But it seems to me that what even that glass half full interpretation might miss is, well, to allude to something that one of your colleagues, Rush Doshi, has written. He wrote before he joined the Biden White House, he said that the United States has never faced an adversary or even a group of adversaries with more than 60% of American GDP. Yeah. China is by far the biggest challenger to America that it has ever faced. No matter who's in charge, that's going to be a major challenge. So I just wonder whether the challenge that the United States faces under no matter the administration, no matter the worldview that administration brings, is actually too large to allow for a continuation of, let's say, late 20th century democratic-style liberal internationalism.
Yeah, firstly, I agree. I mean, genuinely, and I wasn't trying to say that the glass half full part or when internationalists are there, there would be kumbaya or even very smooth sailing. Mm-hmm. I don't think we had smooth sailing when we were in the White House, right? We had two major wars, a lot of pretty difficult competition with China that we were just talking about, yep. Major technological changes. So I think even with an internationalist administration, we're in quite rough times. Like that pre-war environment is not entirely to do with Trump, right? I think
right.
We have to manage that very carefully. We have to manage those tensions. Part of managing them is deterrence, it is being strong, it is having a situation of strength with allies. Part of it is also diplomacy. There will be disputes with allies. You know, there will be differences over how to manage some of these things. You know, there's all sorts of issues that will arise. But, you know, I think that's sort of one thing, right? The other thing is that when you have an administration like we have now, you still have a lot of those problems, but they're even worse, right? Because there's a question about whether the U.S. is even a reliable ally to its friends and partners. And countries that are worried about China, worried about Russia, worried about North Korea, also to be worried in a slightly different way about the United States, right? And so, yeah, I think we're in a challenging period regardless. But obviously, I think I would prefer to have the set of problems that arises from having an internationalist administration that's working with its friends mm-hmm. rather than the type of problems we have at the moment.
All right, let me open it up. If you could just put your hand up, and there's a microphone roving around.
Hey, thanks for the chat. Just going back onto the oscillation between two ideologies in Washington, I'm interested what you think about perhaps a third, not exactly ideology, also being part of that. I think when you look at Washington at the moment, you have the kind of America First kind of Claremont Institute aligned sort of operators. And then on the other side, you have the more traditional Republican kind of Marco Rubio types. Then I would say there perhaps might be a third, which is kind of the Trump style MAGA Republicans, more like the Pete Hegseth types that don't seem to be as ideologically disciplined as the other two. They seem to be perhaps a third wing. Like an example of this would be that I think 80% of MAGA Republicans supported the war in Iran after being the 100% that supported, you know, no forever wars. I'm interested how that fits into the kind of the oscillation between the two parties.
Yeah, no, it's a great question and very fair comment. I think you're right. I mean, I think there's going to be on both Republicans and by Democrats an internal debate about what their policy looks like. I guess I was saying that I think the Republican one is likely to be some version of America First. We don't quite know exactly which type. Some of that depends on the candidate. Some of that depends on the war, how it goes. Some of it depends on, you know, a variety of other things that how much is associated with Trump as a person, how much is sort of more this MAGA or America First intellectual movement that's emerged. So I think we need to wait and see. But regardless of how that comes out, it will, I think, be quite different to traditional internationalism. And the same is true sort of on the internationalist democratic side, too. I think it will come out close to where Biden was, although I think everyone will claim it had nothing to do with him, it's totally new, but I think substantively it'll be similar, but there'll be a debate on that. There'll be a progressive alternative that will probably be less interested in strategic competition, more interested in cooperation and in cutting the defense budget, and that will be resolved in the primary. So I think, yeah, I very much agree. It's still very much in play.
By the way, Tom's book was finished before the Iran war kicked off. And tomorrow morning, The Interpreter, which is our magazine, will publish what we're calling an epilogue to the book, a 2,500-word essay by Tom on the Iran war. And one of the things you note in there is that the president's support among the MAGA crowd appears to be holding up despite the Iran war.
For the moment, yeah.
Well, good evening, Tom and Sam. Thanks for this presentation. It's been really interesting. I'd just like to ask about considering what you see as the unravelling and potentially major powers having the ability to have more bandwidth in terms of what they can do in the world and effectively get away with in the world. How will controls on that, like nuclear deterrence, affect that into the future?
Yeah, it's a huge question. I mean, I think one of the reasons we haven't had proliferation is because of extended deterrence. The United States saying, as you know, that an attack on an allied country, even a conventional attack, could be met with the use of nuclear weapons. And there's always been some doubt about that. We've gone to great efforts to try to make that credible, most recently with South Korea. But basically, for an allied country, that has to work 100% of the time, right? It can't just work 50% of the time. Now, Trump and his administration have actually sort of embraced it, but I think it's there's a question around it, right? Because if you're not willing to defend countries conventionally in a traditional way, why would you be willing to, you know, risk nuclear attack to defend them, right? It just doesn't really sort of add up. And so I think...
Or we could go further. If you actually threaten to militarily attack a NATO ally such as Denmark...
Yeah, exactly. So I think there are real questions about that. And I think there's also a question from a U.S. perspective, you know, which is the most stable, we believe for a very long time, the most stable situation is extended deterrence. Is that still the case? I think that's a large question. So I don't know the answer to it, but I think we will see renewed pressure, especially from South Korea over time, but also maybe others, to reconsider their options in this regard.
Right at the back there. Sorry, Rach, to make you go all the way around. But
hello, thank you, and thanks for your discussion. I look forward to reading your essay tomorrow about the implications and consequences of the war in the Gulf region. But I wonder if you could talk about whether or not what's happening there is, in fact, a China play. There are some people who argue that this is a way of stymieing the Chinese economy, cutting off energy flows, punishing China and trying to contain it because it is dominating the processing, for instance, of critical minerals, which we saw last year came into play with the decision by the Trump administration to stop the export of semiconductors, for instance, and the retaliation from China that stopped the flow of the ingredients for that. And I just wonder, can you put those two things into play? There's a lot of dynamics there. The China-Russia-Iran dynamic is very strong, and I wonder how much thought the Trump administration has put into that in its mess that we see in the Gulf area.
And maybe we can add to that, Tom, the Venezuela operation, because there is also a version of that argument relating to Venezuela, which is that this is all about China and that the Trump administration is playing 4D chess here while the rest of us are playing checkers.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I don't believe that it is to do with China. I think in the Iran case, there was a very clear sort of explanation, which is both the U.S. administration and Israel believed that Iran was at its weakest point in 47 years, and that because of the enmity with Iran and what it has done in the past, that there was an unprecedented opportunity to basically destroy the regime, or failing that, to deal it a devastating blow for which it would never recover. And so it was, by definition, I think, a war of choice, that both believed there was an opportunity to do this. I think that was obviously mistaken. I think it was knowable at the time that it was mistaken. I think Iran has emerged from this, weakened a little bit militarily, but it has discovered, you know, this weapon it has in the Strait of Hormuz, and also its ability to sustain attacks on the Gulf and Israel throughout the war. And I think the China component, you know, Trump has not really been that interested in competition with China, and he hasn't really prioritized it. He's declared a G2. So I'm sort of skeptical that in Iran or Venezuela, that's where he's sort of making his move. You know, usually they talk about it in the context of Venezuela or Greenland, for that matter, only instrumentally. It's more of a justification for what he wants to do for other reasons. In the Iran case, he's actually been pretty tolerant of China's support for Iran, and he has not really tried to impose costs on China. So, you know, I think it's mainly about Iran. I think he obviously seems like he regrets going in now because it's been much more difficult than he anticipated, and he's in a real bind. We saw just as I was coming here that he basically suspended the Freedom of the Seas operation he announced yesterday. I think he's stuck between some pretty difficult options, none of which are particularly good from his point of view. And I don't think he actually knows which he wants to pick.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid that that takes us out for the evening. We're out of time. Would you join me in thanking Tom Wright?
Unsettling, if not intriguing, this history that we are living through. Thanks to the Lowy Institute for that event with non-resident fellow Thomas Wright, who served with the US National Security Council under Joe Biden, and Sam Roggeveen, Program Director of the Lowy's International Security Program. Thomas's new book is called Inflection Point: Biden, Trump and the Future World Order. And Sam is author of The Echidna Strategy, Australia's Search for Power and Peace. And look, we'll link to Thomas's epilogue, as mentioned in that discussion, written for the Lowy Institute's Interpreter magazine with the title How Trump Got Iran Wrong. We'll link to that from our show notes for today's episode. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Next on Big Ideas, two women join me who have endured the most unimaginable because of their journalism, the tenacious Cheng Lei and Charlotte Grieve, on when their story became the story. I'll catch you then. Find and share Big Ideas with your friends via ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.